The next symposium that we will have was born from the idea that the truth is, I have to give credit to, it's always Rabbi, not always, but Rabbi Dr. Eichmann loves doing this. He loves reading newspapers, journals that exist, and usually he always tries to give a lecture the day of, or the day before, or the day after that something was published. He gets excited when, it's July the 5th and this came out on July the 4th. Rabbi Tendler, when he used to give shiur to us at YU, was very fond of the New England Journal of Medicine, used to always publish on Monday. And they would put the date in advance. So he was fond of actually giving the lecture. He would talk about it before it came even. And his idea on that was that in Bizman HaZeh, today's world, that the Nebuah has fallen to Shoftim, but anyways, that was his commentary. And those that know Rabbi Tendler can appreciate where that comes from. But so over the course of the year, the reality is we pick up newspapers all the time. Some cases are over the year sensational cases that linger in the news for months and months and months. Some of them are very quick, little read. And over the year, what the committee has done is collected these cases and essentially sent them and put them in a format where we took 9 cases, we gave 3 of them to each of the 3 speakers today, and basically the question that we're going to ask them is, what would the rabbi say? So this is really a bullet point type of a presentation. The lengthy Mari Nekomos and the back and forth, we're trying to minimize that, but what would the rabbi say? Rosh Ei Prokif, what are the sort of points here? And each of them will have 30 minutes to present 3 cases that have been presented to them. You have them inside your manual to follow along. And we will begin with the first set of cases. Rabbi Black, if I can call you up, please.
So the 3 cases that I've been assigned, I don't know if they're in the exact same order. I'll mention each case first. I will not read the entire case presentation. I will just highlight it or sum it up for you if you haven't had a chance to read them. The first one that I've been asked to discuss is, should developmentally delayed individuals be denied organ transplants? And this is based upon a case that sparked a national debate. A 3-year-old girl who had significant underlying non-fatal other medical conditions. This specific case, she was mentally retarded, quote, and cognitively impaired, unable to walk or talk. And she had kidney failure, and she was seen in CHOP, Children's Hospital, Philadelphia, and she had an evaluation which indicated that she, in fact, would benefit without discussing, quote, quality of life issues, but purely from a medical point of view, would be a candidate for a kidney transplant. However, a decision was made not to place her on the organ recipient list. Her parents said that this was essentially discrimination against her, which is illegal in the United States and in many other countries, to discriminate against the person because of a medical or physical handicap. And this really went viral, no pun intended, and she was subsequently, because of the outcry, legislation was actually passed in New Jersey that would penalize any hospital that would deny patients transplant based upon such disability, intellectual disability, and subsequently she did undergo, I believe, a transplantation. Question is, what does halacha have to say about this? So, just as an introduction to how I posit this, somebody in my shul comes up to me and asks me a question. So, the first and most important thing that I think every physician has to know, and every rabbi has to know, is what you have the capacity to posit and what you don't have the capacity to posit. What you have the capacity to treat, what you don't have the capacity to treat. So, every physician needs to know what they can handle, what they can't handle. Every Rav needs to know what he's capable of handling, what he's not capable of handling. I say the Harav applies to Rabbanim as well. And these types of questions are not something that a Rav is approached with the conclusion of davening is he's walking out of shul, as the vast majority of shilas that I get are when I'm leaving shul. By the way, Rabbi, is this business dealing ethical or not? Those types of shilas really should be well thought out, well planned, given adequate time to discuss, and if they're within the ken of the rabbi or the physician to take care of it, they have the halachic right to do so. And the most important words for a physician or a rabbi to know is, I do not know the answer to that. I will ask somebody and hopefully come up with the correct response. In fact, one of the most beautiful explanations for the famous statement that Chazal told the rabbi of the Gehenna, the best of doctors are going downstairs rather than upstairs, is based upon this idea that the person who thinks he's the best, Tov Shivarov, I'm the best doctor in the entire world. And therefore, who is, like Hung said, who would be better equipped to be honored than me? Who is better equipped to answer this question than me? So such a rope, goes straight to Gehenna. If you don't ask your colleagues, if you don't seek out other opinions, so when the rope is presented to Shaila, he has to know. It says in Shulchan Aruch, you have to repeat Yalla B'Yavo if you forgot it on this and this occasion. You don't repeat it. So that's, person can posit that. But questions like this, I think we sometimes run into great trouble nowadays when we have people that are, quote, rabbis, but they're not qualified to pass in certain shilas, or they make statements or wish to make statements that unfortunately aggrandize themselves, and they'll pass in shilas for Klal Yisrael when they really don't have the right to do so. I mean, in your own people hopefully understand what I'm saying when you have policies that have been in existence for 2,000 years and some local person who has the name Rabbi in front of his name, who learned 2 years in a smicha program, and suddenly he's making pronouncements all of Klal Yisrael that this thing or practice that Klal Yisrael has done for 2,000 years can be changed because I once saw in the Sefer, in the Sefer Shulchan Sefer, that somebody suggested on a theoretical basis that this might be applicable. It's not how we pass the laws. This is just an opening statement that's probably more important than anything specific that I'm going to say. How does a rav pass in a shaila? So if you get a shadow like this, the average rabbi is really not going to be equipped to paskin for Klal Yisrael, but he may be able to paskin for that specific individual patient. On this one, I think there's a very simple answer that one can bring to the table. And when you look at a shadow like this, you have to ask, what are the potential reasons to forbid transplantation in such a child? So in the secular world, the reasons that this child was initially denied a transplantation was because it's a, quote, waste of a resource that is extremely limited. And why should we, quote, waste such a resource on, quote, such an impaired individual? Now that is what a secular ethicist may decide and say that this quality of life of this child is not worthwhile to expend such resources on. This is not limited to a 3-year-old child with a cognitive impairment. This is nice in hospitals when you're talking about 80-year-olds, 90-year-olds, 100-year-olds. We shouldn't be expending resources on such people. After all, what is the quality of life? What is the duration of life that this person has? Stop butchering them and let them die in dignity. Now, these are concepts that Lani has got here totally connected halacha. Halacha doesn't distinguish between a person who is an IQ of 150 versus an IQ of 120 versus an IQ of 80. We value life. Life is not defined as what you got on your SAT, or if we took a vote in the community, how many people liked you and say you would go to the head of the list or you don't go to the head of the list. Halacha gives infinite value to life. That's not to say that you can't use factors such as the success of the operation, the likelihood of this donor being a successful recipient, a successful donor for this patient, the likelihood that this recipient will successfully undergo the operation from a both medical and psychological point of view. And halacha also looks at consent. You need to be a far das in order to be able to give a matana, for example. A child by halacha cannot give a matana. We have this issue comes up every year, Sukkot time. A parent buys a lulav and esrog for themselves, and they're insured with their 10-year-old son, and they shake lulav and esrog, they give it to their 10-year-old son. He now possesses it. He wants them to own it. He owns it, and then you go home and bring a little bit of Esther to your wife, and you want your wife to be Yotzi with it. So then I did. She can't be Yotzi without him the first day because she's not fulfilling the concept of Lokach and Lochen. You have to own it. But the 10-year-old gave it to her. He loves his mommy. And the answer is the 10-year-old doesn't have the halachic right to give a matana. So this is very, very important in organ donation. It could theoretically be a concern as well in recipients. How do we know that this child wants to undergo such a procedure? So if it's not absolutely halachically a chiyuv for this child to undergo the procedure, then we start running into questions of, are we allowed to make decisions for such a child that involve risk to that child? So this is much more clear in the situation where you're donating something. This was alluded to in the session we had early this morning, is a minor, i.e. a child who is not a bar das, a child who halachically could be a genius, the Vilna Gaon at the age of 11 is going to be an awful lot smarter than 9 will ever be, and yet the Vilna Gaon at the age of 11 is not a bar das. So therefore, there are halachic questions that need to be addressed in terms of giving, less so in terms of receiving, but you still have to make halachically correct decisions. So the kids are in this situation. The most and single most important question to me would have to be addressed is the medical necessity. Is giving this child a kidney transplant medically the best interest of this child? And that is something that both psychologists, medical people, transplant specialists, all the other appropriate people that need to make that decision need to come up with the answer. If the answer isn't a clear yes, it's definitely in the benefit of this child, then you have halachic questions. How are we allowed to do this procedure on a 3-year-old child? It has to be something clearly in the benefit of that child. However, once it is decided that halachically it's in the benefit of this child, so then, the question is no longer a halachic question, are you allowed to give it to this child? The question is, this child needs to be triaged in the way that we triage appropriately anybody that is in need of a kidney, which is often, not 100%, but often on a list, who first come, first serve. And they're placed on the list as a potential recipient, they're appropriately matched, and then halachically, I believe the answer would be clear that such a child is entitled to be on the list as much as a Nobel Peace Prize winning scientist or person who's 30 years old and has 7 kids and is certainly extremely important to that family. This 3-year-old child is equally, in HaKadosh Baruch Hu's eyes, is a neshama that needs to be preserved just as much as the Nobel Prize winner. And the normal halachic rules, Lani Adati would apply over here. We do not view this 3-year-old child in any halachic way as less of a life than a person who is, quote, not cognitively impaired. And Lani Adati, that would be the simple answer over here. There may be pratim that a rav, when he passes this halacha lemaisa, might have to delve into. Again, I point out psychological issues are very, very important, and in halacha, we view medical and psychological issues as the same. We don't differentiate, that's super tentorial, that's something that we don't care about. We only care about organic stuff. A, we're learning more and more that a lot of the super tentorial stuff is just as organic, but even if it's not, even if it's a, quote, irrational, non-organic that we can define, that's something that halacha does take into account, and you need the appropriate psychological and medical evaluation. Is this transplant in the best interest of this child? So, that's how I would approach this if this was asked to me. But when these decisions are being made on a global basis, you really need posting of stature to address if you're making policy for Eretz Yisrael, you're making policy for even a secular country, and they're looking to see what does the halacha have to say. So then there are other issues and factors that may come up when you're really dealing with triage issues. There just never aren't enough kidney donors, there aren't enough organs available, so then there are other factors that may be decided on a societal basis. The government does have the right to put in certain policies. In certain countries, you won't get an organ donation above a certain age. You won't get an organ donation if you smoke still. You won't get an organ donation if you drink still, depending on the liver or the lung, what you're dealing with, because we don't want to, quote, waste it, whereas halacha may say that may not be an absolute factor, but society has the right to make certain rules and regulations that may be not connected to halacha, but are separate from halacha. So that would be my answer to question number one. Question number two, there's no write-up, but it's certainly something that has made a tremendous amount of discussion in the medical literature as well as in the lay literature, and that is, should prisoners be allowed to donate organs? So there are two types of prisoners. There are prisoners that are going to eventually be let out of jail, and there are prisoners that are on death row, and they're not going to be let out of jail in a vertical position, only in a horizontal position. They're going to be lethally executed. Speaking of Inyana Dioma, most people have probably heard about a case in the United States where a person was sentenced to death and was, in fact, carried out 2-3 days ago in an extremely inefficient manner. I think it took 1 hour and 57 minutes for the lethal injection to take effect, and eyewitnesses describe that the patient was gasping for breath. And I'm not going to get into a moral or hashkafic discussion, is that a good thing or a bad thing, that a person who was a vicious murderer should suffer in his death? That's for HaKadosh Baruch Hu to answer, that's not for me to answer. We don't believe in giving a person halachically anything other than the most humane death. Many of the laws of Misa are based upon the concept of Bror Lo Misa Yofeh. That means a person who's a rotzeach, a person who's a horrible person, from an objective or subjective point of view, everybody is happy that this guy is going to die. The guy himself is happy he's going to die. He realizes he's a horrible person. So Beis Din has a chiyu Bror Lo Misa Yofeh. You have an obligation to kill him in the least painful, in the most compassionate way. For argument's sake, the four Mises spaces of Achlokas, which are the more stringent, which are the less stringent, of Shimon and the Chachamim, it is forbidden to kill somebody in a more stringent way if they're not halachically required to get that Mises. So for example, we posited that skila, stoning, which means pushing the person off a high point, is the most chumradik of Misa, the most severe type of Misa. So you're forbidden to give that type of misa to somebody who's a murderer, because that person is only chayev to be killed in a less severe way. He gets chedek. You're not allowed to give a person who's obligated to receive a stricter misa, a lesser misa, a stricter misa, because bror lo misa yofeh, we have an obligation. So we certainly don't engage in the polemic of, this guy was a rapist. He killed this family in a horrible way. He made them suffer. He made the Avodah make him suffer. So that's not our way. HaKadosh Baruch Hu has something called Gehenna. HaKadosh Baruch Hu has many ways to punish people that is outside the human realm, that's up to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. As much as we may sometimes wish to have somebody suffer because they're horrible people, a terrorist who terrorizes people, we want them to suffer, that's not our way. And we have to separate emotion from halacha. Halacha would require that we give this person a misa yofeh. Halacha does recognize, under, again, the appropriate halacha considerations, that you can give this person misa. I'm not going to get into the polemic of should we or should we not be doing capital punishment in the United States. I will say that under the appropriate conditions, halacha does sanction this. So the question that this case revolves about is, well, you're going to kill the guy anyway. He has a very good heart. He's a 22-year-old guy. His heart's beating strong. He has good lungs. Kidneys are in fine condition. A liver that is perfectly acceptable. You can save 10 people's lives by, A, cutting this person open while he's alive, so you don't have any of the questions about the viability of the organs. Take the beating heart out of this person. Have the guy either transplanted into 20 feet away, And do it that way. You couldn't ask for a better heart. Even a person who has quote brain death, it still is not as good a heart to take from a healthy 22-year-old who is not in a car accident. So the secular ethicists have this principle that you have to be dead in order to be a donor. And in the secular world, nobody would allow a person to be have their heart removed at the method of killing them. Even if everybody was in agreement, that God will take that heart and give it to a person. Would halacha sanction something like that? So the answer is no, because halacha doesn't accept that as one of the forms of misa spesdin. So there really is no way to go and, what, at least on a theoretical level, would be the ideal way for a prisoner on death row to donate his organs, which would be to take him out while he's still alive and kill him by taking out his heart, rather than through lethal execution or with a gunshot or whatever form of capital punishment that society has decided to use. So the question then becomes, can you kill this person with a lethal injection and then use their organs? So there are a number of medical questions that have to be answered if the ingredients that you're using to kill this guy are also going to harm the heart or cause a problem in the salvage of the organs. Obviously, it's not a medical opportunity. The other questions that arise, which I think can easily be negated, are, well, patients on death row probably have a higher rate of transmissible pathogens, have a higher rate of poor organs, etc. And the answer to that would be very simple. Well, they'll test them. The guy's on death row. You have ample time to do the most fancy and expensive and appropriate diagnostic testing to guarantee that he doesn't really have a hepatitis C. He doesn't really have cancer someplace in his body that's unrecognized. So you could actually somewhat paradoxically make the argument that a death row patient can be screened better than the donor cycle victim, the person who's riding a motorcycle and knocks his head, as a typical donor for a transplant, and he's going to die in 24 hours, and you have to do everything in a more rushed situation. So from a point of view of salvage of the organs, I think it's a specious argument to say that you can't do this in a jailed life, a death row patient. You may have a smaller number, you're right, many of them are going to have contraindications from a medical point of view, but nefesh achas, even if you could have one person saved, I think from a halachic point of view, the answer would be that there is no halachic reason that a person on death row would not be allowed halachically to donate. And the arguments in the secular world are, is this appropriate? Do we want to give this guy a chance to do tshuva? And again, the halachic argument would be is that we certainly would want this person to do tshuva. We have a constant desire that expressed by Bruria to her husband, Rav Meir, the Gemara of Brachos, amongst many other places, Yitavu Chatoyim in Ha'aretz. And Rav Meir said, he davened for these people who were Rishayim, that they should die. And his wife, Bruria, bested him in the argument, and the Gemara concludes that Bruria is correct. No, Yitavu Chatoyim, it doesn't say Chotim. We don't want the sinners to die, we want the sinners to die. So nothing would please us more than this person should do tshuva. Nevertheless, halacha demands that a person be killed, so the person has to be killed. You can't do tshuva for Mises Beitin. The guy becomes a tzaddik. He's sitting in death row. Oh, he gets an epiphany, and he becomes a tzaddik. He's learning 20 hours a day on death row. He's a tzaddik gomor by any definition that you have. He's now the god lador. Everybody comes to him for questions. He's sitting on death row. The din is you're absolutely not allowed to save this guy. He is mechuyav mises beis din. Again, I'm talking about mises beis din, different than capital punishment. He's mechuyav mises beis din. It is awesome for the beis din to spare this person's life. So nothing would please us more on a theoretical basis. And we have the most unbelievable history. You have children of the Third Reich. You have Nazis, their children, grandchildren, relatives, sitting in Kollel in Eretz Yisrael learning. We had a person in our shul, his father was a guy, a decorated, Yimach Shemo Zichro, officer in the Third Reich. He was misgayer, he served in Tzahal. He's 100% the Tov Shabbat Torah Mitzvah's Jew. 10 years ago. We have the children of many Rishayim in the Gemara. You have Russia after Russia, B'nai Homer, are sitting in a base measure someplace. You have many other examples. The nephew of Titus Arosha wrote Targum Onkelus. There are many examples of our biggest enemies, the biggest Rishayim. They have relatives and children of the Chula, and you have the butcher of all, Nebu Zarad, described in the Gemara as the butcher. And he did Chula, according to many, became a Gerd Sebek. He killed more people than Hitler Yimach Shemo killed. Is a rush of Gomor, and yet our approach is they do tshuva. So the argument that we shouldn't allow a person on death row to donate because they should suffer and they shouldn't have a single zechus is not a halachic Jewish idea. In fact, Yeshua Mishakon Olam Bishachas is a person that can acquire his olam ba'emes in the second of doing tshuva. The Gemara in the Daf Yomi we just learned recently, there's a story that Rishima Bar Yochai was being sought out by the goyim. They wanted to kill him. And there was a senator who was involved in this proclamation who on the sly came to Shimon Bar Yochai and he said to him, if I save your life, will you guarantee me all Olam Haba? He was a great person. because Gemara is going to say he was a great person, but up until that point in his life, I don't know if Gemara would have said he was a great person. He was either a Roman senator or a person who was in very high circles in a society that was persecuting Jews left and right. And he went to Shulam Yochai and said, "Will you guarantee me that I'll be a Ben Olam Haba?" Shulam Yochai was able to do so. He said, "Yes, I guarantee you that you'll be a Ben Olam Haba." This Roman senator went up to the top of the roof, jumped off the roof, and a bas call rang out from Shemayim that said, "Kana Olamo, he has acquired his Olam Haba in 1 second. After a life of potential rishus, he acquired Olam Haba in 1 second." And the way that that worked was he was part of the initial decree against Rebbe, and they had a custom that if one of the promulgators of the decree died, it was a sin in Hashemayim that the decree was wrong, and the decree automatically became abrogated. So he saved Shimon bar Yochai's wife from life, and he was coming along with Mishra'ach. So again, it's a specious argument to say that we don't want to give a person on death row the opportunity to do a chesed with his organs. So again, let me ask that, if I was asked this question, should a prisoner be allowed to donate organs? There's absolutely no halachic reason why you might not want to do that. They then become just practical questions. Can you require the organs in the right way? Is this something that society wishes to do or not do? Which to me isn't always the best way to answer a question, because we have a lot of people in society that aren't capable of answering the question. These questions should ideally be left to Talmidei Chachamim and people that are knowledgeable on the subject. But again, Mania Zati, there is no halachic reason why a person who's on death row should not be allowed to donate his organs if it's physically possible. And then the third question that I've been asked to address is the question about women with transplanted wombs who are now trying to get pregnant. And this is from the Toronto Star, March 4th, 2014. For those that don't know, Toronto is a city above the United States. And in Toronto, this is a Maisa Shahoya. They reported over here that there were four women who had obviously something, a problem with their uterus, either, I don't know the technical details, they may not have had a uterus that was properly formed, it was removed because of cancer, I don't know what the details were, but they had embryos transferred into these rooms in an attempt to get pregnant. And the question basically is asking, is this halachically allowed for a woman to take an organ from someone else as a uterus for the purpose of getting pregnant? So this is a different shaila than a pikuach nefesh shaila. If this was a liver or a kidney or an organ, even something that's not essential for life, such as a cornea transplant, or any other of the types of transplants that we can now do nowadays that aren't life-threatening, a hand transplant, a face transplant, doing various other types of bone prosthetic types of things and dental surgery. So these things are not life-threatening, but are absolutely going to improve the quality of life for that person. So halacha certainly allows a person to undergo reconstructive surgery after breast cancer surgery. Halacha clearly says that that's permissible, even though it's absolutely not going to do anything in terms of prolonging the woman's life, but it will make her life more comfortable. It will make her life a happier life. Halacha certainly allows one to undergo such reconstructive surgeries. The question here is different in that this has absolutely nothing to do with her life, at least from a medical point of view. This deals really with her desire for her to have children. So this is on a number of levels a very complex shaila. Number one, women, somewhat surprisingly if you haven't heard this before, have absolutely no chiyuv of puravu. The chiyuv of puravu, at least according to the majority opinion of the Gemara, is a mitzvah that is 100% incumbent upon men. Slight technical problem that you can't do it by yourself if you're a man, and you require a woman. However, with the exception of the opinion of Yochanan ben Nuri, who says that women are also obligated in the mitzvah of puravu, there is absolutely no obligation upon a woman to have children. I heard from my rabbeim, that is why HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave such a strong maternal instinct into women, because they are technically putting themselves in a matzah of sakana every time they get pregnant. Baruch Hashem, today, the matzah of sakana is diminished. It's a Baruch Hashem. If a hospital has a maternal death, that hospital gets scrutinized like crazy. You should almost never have a maternal death nowadays. But 50 to 100 years ago, the maternal death rates were probably 10 to 15% in many institutions in many countries, and it's probably not that much better today in many third world countries where the level of obstetrical prenatal care, perinatal care, and postnatal care is almost what it was 100 years ago, and not much better. And the Gemara talks about this in great detail. Is a man allowed to marry his dead wife's sister? Because that was very frequently the only available shidduch, the only way to take care of Kenan Har. There were four pitzalach around, and then the wife died in the fifth child. Who's going to want to raise these children other than the aunt, the maternal aunt? And the Gemara has cases where they talked about a woman being married. Her sister just passed away, and she's being married on the way back from the cemetery because somebody had to take care of these children. And these are, unfortunately, Maizibu Choyom in prior history. So there's a tremendously strong maternal desire that HaKadosh Baruch Hu put into women to put them into this situation where there was a great risk in childbirth. Lemaisa, there is no obligation for a woman to undergo this procedure. So if a woman were to ask, am I obligated to undergo this procedure? The answer is clearly no. She certainly has no obligation to put herself into a situation that's dangerous for her in order to have children. And this is true in many fertility treatments. The woman doesn't have such an obligation. The question becomes, what about her husband in that situation? Is he allowed to remain married to her? Is he allowed to l'chatchila get married to her? Does he have children? Does he not have children already? Is he kind of mitzvah for a vote? So there are many other interesting ramifications of the shiloh, but that's not what I was asked to talk about. Purely from the woman's point of view, she has absolutely no obligation to undergo this surgery. Is she allowed to undergo the surgery? Absolutely yes. This is no different than a woman wishing to undergo reconstructive surgery because it's very important to her what her body appearance is. This is no less important. This woman is very much desirous of having her own child and wishes to undergo such a procedure. Halacha gives her the right to do so. What to me would be the critical question is to make sure that from a psychological point of view that she's doing this, I don't want to use the term shame shemayim, but she's doing this with a full understanding of what the consequences are. This child that's going to be produced in the milieu of immunosuppressive therapy, this child that's going to be produced in the realm of taking various drugs, and the consequence of the increased risk of this child is something that needs to be absolutely understood. I think from a halachic point of view, the risks are small enough that they would fall into the category of where it's permissible to do this. But again, the husband and the wife in this situation, on the Azdati, should be very, very carefully evaluated to make sure that they understand that the risk that they're taking, is this really the true and best option for them? Maybe adoption is a better option for them. There are many children out there that would love to be brought up in a loving family. Again, we just had an Daf Yomi very recently that Chazal tell us that a person who raises another person is considered that they're the parents of that person. The unbelievable chesed to taking a child who's not your biological child, but to raise them as if they were your own child. The Rumo Shalom, that those people that do that, you adopt the child, take care of the child. Those are the greatest mitzvahs that a person can do. And sometimes that may be a much smarter medical option, a much smarter psychological option for the family than bringing in a child under much more difficult medical circumstances. Again, there's not a simple answer in halacha. This is right, this is wrong. I think halachically it's permissible to do something like this. Whether it's advisable or not really would depend on the medical factors in terms of the immunosuppression, the drugs that would need to be taken, and the availability of other options in terms of both medical solutions to the infertility in this situation, surrogate motherhood, adoption, etc., etc. Those would be the factors that I would focus in on lemaisa in deciding whether this should be done. But again, I think from a pure halachic point of view, this would be something that halacha would condone, but would not necessarily recommend. Thank you very much.
Okay, Rabbi Reichman, this is yours. This is your baby.
Shkaya for Blazer. I begin with a story which I suspect you may have heard from me in the past, but it's very relevant to this whole session. It's the story of a philosopher who's asked to travel to China to deliver a keynote address at a major international philosophical conference. So, of course, the man doesn't speak any Chinese, so they hire a translator for him. And he coordinates with the translator beforehand, and he says, translator says, don't worry, I will let you know when I'm ready to translate. I'll give you the sign. So the professor stands up for the keynote address, room filled with 1,000 participants, begins his discussion. After a moment or two, he turns to the Chinese translator to translate. The translator says, keep going, don't worry, I'll tell you when to stop. This goes on for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes. He stops him, he says, I'll translate. The Chinese translator stands up, says 5 words in Chinese. So this goes on, another 15 minutes, it comes up, says 5 minutes in Chinese, and another 15 minutes, and finally he completes his session and everybody files out of the room. So the professor goes over to the translator after the session. He says, you must be a genius. I spent my entire life working on this presentation, and you were able to concise my words into just a few comments. What's your secret? What did you do? So he says to him, after the first 15 minutes, I said, so far he hasn't said anything new. After the next 15 minutes, I said, he still hasn't said anything new. After the third, I said, it doesn't look like he's going to say anything new. After the fourth, I said, I was right, he did. So as opposed to, no offense, I hope you know philosophers here in the audience, but as opposed to philosophy, where you can indeed go for a fair period of time without much new, in the world of science and medicine, which the entire session is reflective of that fact, it is simply not the case today. Things are proceeding at such a rapid pace that I suspect by the end of this conference on Sunday, we will probably be reading things in the newspaper that we didn't even anticipate. So Laser has collected some wonderful cases for us to discuss today, and I will discuss three of those cases for you this afternoon. Case number one is the following, called Next Generation Sequencing May Be the Future of In Vitro Fertilization. And I'll read just a little bit of the case. A baby in Philadelphia is the first to be born with the help of a new technology that experts hope will make it easier for infertile couples to become pregnant. And the Next Generation Sequencing guarantees the chromosomal integrity of an embryo before it is returned to the mother. So in essence, what it does is it does genetic testing of the embryo through this so-called next-generation sequencing in order to be able to determine that the embryo they are about to implant in the process of in vitro fertilization is a useful and successful, will be a successful implantation. This raises potential questions, one that arises with nearly every advance in assisted technology, about what limits society wants to place on how and why embryos are screened, if it is acceptable to only transfer embryos that are pre-screened for viability, what about those that are determined not to carry certain diseases, etc., etc. What is next-generation sequencing? I am not a geneticist. I don't know the real micro-details. But one thing that it has done, it's known as high-throughput sequencing. It's a catch-all term used to describe a number of different modern sequencing technologies. And the bottom line is, it allows scientists to sequence the human genome in exponentially faster ways than has ever been possible. So it is now possible to sequence the entire human genome, the genome of the adults, the genome of the fetus, the genome of the embryo, in all different ways, shapes, and forms, in something that our predecessors could never have dreamed of. But now we're getting all this tremendous amount of information. What do we do with all this information? How do we digest this information? How do we apply this information? How do we integrate all this information? What is the halakhic approach to genetic testing? And here we have a cartoon. The angel saying to God, says, God, the human genome code has been unraveled. So God says, those darn hackers, now I have to change the password. Some have actually suggested that the very morphology or shape of the Hebrew letters is akin to the actual human chromosomes. And here you have the Aleph Beis in chromosome alphabet. So here's Aleph, Beis, Gimel, Dalet, Hei, Bet, Zayin, Bet. And you say HaKadosh Baruch Hu Yisachel Boreitzo Bora Alma. The human genome really is our Torah in a sense. That is our code, which encodes how we become human beings and the lives that we live. So I'd like to discuss briefly the application. Obviously this is a very vast topic, far beyond that we can discuss in these few minutes. But just to share with you the major areas that genetic testing and next generation sequencing has and is continuing to be applied in our generation. So one of those is the testing of the adults, screening the adults for human disease. And here we have a fascinating study which a reporter from New York or the New York Times did. He decided to do the following. It's a great story. He said, I'm a healthy guy. I don't have any particular disease. I will take my entire human genome and test it, see if I have any disease or predisposition to disease, and let's see where the chips fall, and let's see what kind of story we make. So he tests his entire human genome, and he finds out that he has a high risk for type 2 diabetes. The research team did extensive blood tests every 2 months or more, keeping track of 40,000 molecules in Snyder's cells. About midway into the 14th month study, analysis showed that Snyder had indeed developed diabetes. My genome did predict I was at risk, he said, and because I was watching out, I detected illness pretty early. So he probably detected it the earliest possible way, the earliest that could have ever possibly been detected. He was testing himself very, very frequently because he knew he had a predisposition to the disease. So does that extrapolate to the fact that everyone in this room now should go out and perform human genome testing to see what our predispositions are and to see what our genetics are? So we obviously have discussed in this conference and will continue to discuss the notion of preservation of health. And we all have an obligation to monitor our blood pressure, monitor our cholesterol, make sure we're healthy. So does that notion of extend to human to full human genome testing? So I think the answer to that is a qualified no. At this particular stage, but I want to hasten to add that one of the fascinating things about, and unfortunately challenging things about living in this generation, is that we are in a perpetual chasm of knowledge. What do I mean by that? It means that scientists are proceeding apace at developing tremendous advances. Usually, they have these extraordinary discoveries, but they don't know the consequence of these discoveries and the clinical application of these discoveries for months to years later. So they throw this information at us on the front page of the New York Times. We now have this exciting information, but nobody knows how to deal with the information. Then the post-humor asks questions about how to deal with it. So for example, the BRCA gene, which we're not discussing really extensively here, when that first came out, people really didn't know how to respond to it. People didn't know it's a breast cancer gene. Should we test for it? Should we not test for it? Who should test for it? Who should we divulge the information to? So we're gathering much, much more information now than we ever had, but there's a fairly long period of time where we have the information, but we don't know what to do with it. So that's the case here with complete human genome testing. Admittedly, there are a number of genes which are useful, which can help us identify predisposition to disease, can help us identify existing disease. But there's a massive amount of information in this test, which are genes of unknown significance. So you get this readout, which could be like, you know, a few pages long, of a fair number of genes which doctors have no idea if they're good for you, bad for you, and simply have no idea what to do with them. So I don't believe, personally, it's advisable routinely for people to be undergoing these kinds of tests now, although, admittedly, it may be in the near future. Once the information is more understandable, once the studies have come out about the usefulness and the clinical applicability of these tests, it may indeed fall under the rubric of an Ishmael Kimoto and Ashasei. What about screening for adult carrier status? What's the purpose of screening for adult carrier status? That's not to determine if you have a disease particularly. That's to determine if you are a carrier for a disease. And if you are a carrier for a recessive disease, for example, and you marry another carrier for a recessive disease, there is a percentage possibility that your progeny will be the bearers of that disease. So this is an issue, obviously, which has been discussed extensively in the halachic literature. And it first came about when tapex was the first gene that was identified and testable, interestingly, historically, the very first gene in the medical community that was tested was a gene which afflicted specifically the Jewish community in that state. So that's something which, when it was originally came out, they asked Moshe Feinstein Zatzal whether someone should indeed use this new genetic testing to determine the risk for carrying these diseases and propagating these diseases. And he clearly said that it's testable, it's knowable, it prevents tragedy. One should definitely engage in that kind of testing. And today there are many ways to be tested. There's the Dori Shuri method to be tested, which is an anonymous form of testing. There's Yeshiva University and many others have open forms of testing, and that's something which merits further discussion. But it's clearly welcomed in the Jewish community. Now, what about screening the human embryo, which is the case that was discussed in our case study? So that is possible now. This is also a relatively recent advance in technology, that you can take the human embryo and remove a cell from the human embryo. Actually, I think this is trophectoderm biopsy, where you can remove genetic material from the embryo and send it to the laboratory and do testing. So is that an application of genetic testing that we should be doing? And that has a number of applications. So, for example, one can screen for viability prior to implantation, which is our case study. One can screen for this Tay-Sachs disease prior to implantation. One can screen for predisposition of disease, like the breast cancer gene and others. One can even screen for traits that are not particular diseases: intelligence, sports ability, gender. Trust me, the sports ability gene you will likely not find within the Jewish community. Don't worry about that. So what are the halakhic issues that relate to this? Again, a vast topic, but just for the sake of completeness in our discussion. First of all, it requires assisted reproduction with all its attendant halakhic issues. So in order to perform these tests, you have to harvest the sperm from the man and the eggs from the woman. There are halakhic issues of sperm procurement and egg harvest. Generally, those are only permitted if there is a mitigating reason for them to do it. And also, there's the general rubric of rapo yirapé, that we are allowed to do these procedures for therapeutic purposes, but enhancement types of purposes may not necessarily be permitted, like this last category: genes for traits, not diseases, intelligence, gender, etc. The one area which I'm particularly concerned about is the application not of screening to the embryo, but screening to the fetus in utero. It is now possible, this is a recent study, a non-invasive parental testing using massive parallel sequencing of maternal plasmid DNA to fetal whole genome sequencing, from molecular karyotyping to fetal whole genome sequencing. So in short, what this means is they can inferentially determine the entire human genome of the fetus in utero for a pregnant woman. So here, it's a little more complicated because of the following reasons. If you have an adult can test themselves and they can determine what they want to do with the information, what they don't want to do with the information. If you have an embryo in the laboratory, you can decide, and there are halakhic issues about the human status of the human embryo, and most of the Meforshim, overwhelmingly with some minority dissent, claim that there is less halakhic status. It's not considered a full human being when it's an embryo sitting in the laboratory. But clearly, a pregnant woman with a fetus in utero, there is a prohibition against aborting that fetus unless there is a clear reason. There's a major machlokas aposkim. So if you have a woman today who goes to the OBGYN and gets tested, there are a number of diseases that they test for in utero. They test for potential for Down syndrome, they do fetal ultrasound, they do a whole variety of types of testing. The question is, would a woman want to have literally the entire human genome of the fetus that's carried in her womb? That sounds very appealing. Sounds great. Why would I not want to have this information? The more information, the merrier. But I think it's disastrous, because I think this chasm issue of knowledge, without knowing what to do with that knowledge, could have devastating consequences in this scenario. Because if you have a woman who is pregnant and gets this readout that says, you have certain genes for this, certain genes for that, and you have, say, 20% genes of which we call unknown clinical significance. We don't know if it's going to be great for your baby. We don't know if it's going to be disastrous for your baby. What's a woman going to do? She's going to want to abort. She's going to say, why should I take a risk? Why should I take a chance? So I think the possibility of exponentially increasing abortions is very high. And I think that it's extremely premature to offer this kind of testing to a woman at this stage. It may become relevant, but I think there's a lot more information that needs to be gleaned. This was not the position of this article in the New England Journal, and one of the authors is a friend of mine, Lisa Soleimani. They actually said that the woman should have the option to avail themselves of this information and act accordingly. And I definitely disagree with that. So in response to answer question one, is next generation sequencing permitted in order to identify viable embryos for implantation? So for that purpose, you have a couple that's undergoing infertility treatment under auspices of Rabbonim. They have a PSAC that is permitted, and you're working on a successful implantation. There should be absolutely no reason why you shouldn't be able to test for viability for the embryo, and I think that should be halachically permissible. Case number two, IVF babies denied Canadian citizenship. Where's Canada again, Aaron? I remember it's somewhere close to the United States. I just don't remember exactly where. So this is another fascinating case that the later found. Malkiat, it sounds like an Israeli, modern Israeli name, Malkiat Tendola, always assumed that when his wife gave birth in India through in vitro fertilization, their baby would automatically become a Canadian citizen, like the Vancouver area truck driver himself. But an immigration officer ruled otherwise, and now the Federal Court of Appeal has upheld that decision in a groundbreaking case that raises intriguing questions about the intersection of modern fertility and immigration. Because the embryo used in Ms. Kendola's IVF treatment was made from sperm and egg donors by others, the child has no genetic connection to either parent. So it's a Canadian woman who went to India to get sperm and egg donation, she carried the child, she gave birth to the child in India. So Canada says that this child has no genetic connection to these parents, therefore it is not a Canadian child, even though it was born physically from a Canadian mother. But the law also says, interestingly, on the other hand, any child born on Canadian soil is automatically a citizen. So if you have a non-Canadian woman who had the sperm and egg donation, not her genetic child, but she gives birth to a child in Canada, because she is physically in Canada, that child is Canadian. So that seems to be, it seems to be paradoxical.
Is the mother an Indian citizen? A Canadian citizen? He only says the father.
Oh, it's a good question. I don't know the details more of the case, but I assume the mother was a Canadian citizen too. So the bottom line is that this whole field of assisted reproduction technology has created tremendous confusion about maternity and paternity. Who is the mother of these children? Who is the father of these children? Is it the person who donates the eggs? Is it the person who gives birth to the child? This is a topic we've been discussing over the last number of years. This just reflects the complexity a little bit. Have you met my mothers? This is the genetic mother, the biological mother, the social mother. What are the halakhic ramifications of maternity and paternity? With respect to the fulfillment of Purahu, with respect to the mitzvah of honoring your father and mother, you have to know which mother is your mother to honor. Is it the mother who provided the genes? Is it the mother who provided the womb? Most importantly, if one of the partners in the process is Jewish and one is not, our Jewishness is determined by maternity. So is the child Jewish at all? Does the child need a conversion? Issues of inheritance, issues of yichus, a whole host of things. And obviously the most important question is who gets a part on Mother's Day as the surrogate mother or the genetic mother, and Hallmark pumpkins that both mothers are considered the mother. It's gotten so complicated that you may see an ad like this. I was reformed as an embryo, conservative as a fetus, and orthodox from birth, seeking saints. The seriously, lest you think that the secular world is confused about the definition of maternity, there is equal ambiguity in the within the halakhic literature. There is no consensus in terms of the definition of maternity. I remember when this topic first started 20 years ago, it seemed to be that the preponderance of halakhic opinion was that the birth mother was considered the halakhic mother, and people acted accordingly. Over the last few years, it seems that the pendulum has swung back, that many of the poskim are accepting the genetic mother as the halakhic mother. This is a position from Merle Yashiv Zatzal, who was of the opinion in general that the genetic mother, maybe out of suffix, not necessarily out of the definitive position, but the genetic mother seems to be the primary mother. So with respect to this case, case number two, is this mother who gave birth to the child, but is not the genetic donor, is she considered the legal mother of that child? Should that child be considered a Canadian citizen or not, or a halakhic citizen, if you will? So the answer to that is it's a suffix, it's a doubt. Even within the halakhic literature, there's no absolute consensus. Where it becomes complicated, by the way, and just a brief editorial comment, the field of assisted reproduction is probably one of the most extraordinary fields in modern medicine. The advances that have taken place have been literally mind-numbing just in our generation. It is really a gift of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and we're very fortunate. And we're also fortunate that the Jewish religion, as opposed to others, avails itself of this technology. However, and I'm not minimizing the desire of couples to become pregnant and have a child. It's a tremendous thing, and obviously Rachel Limeinu said, "Probably bani mi'ayin meis ano, if you give me a child, or if not, it's as if I am dead." But having said that, we have to think in some of our thought process needs to go to the child and the consequences for the child. So we are in a situation where children are being born as a result of these arrangements, and their very Jewishness is a matter of debate. So it's complicated. You know, right now, when a rabbi is Masader Kedushin, they don't necessarily ask, were you a product of assisted reproduction or not? But given the statistics, especially in Eretz Yisrael, the percentage of births that are from assisted reproduction, you might rise above the mute. Right now, I think between 2-4% of the population in Israel is being born from assisted reproduction. 10 years from now, it could be over 5-10%. It may indeed be that a rabbi will have to ask that, and will have to actually determine maternal status, and paternal status could complicate things quite a bit. And just a plug for our discussion tonight, if that child who is a product of a debated maternity and ends up having a gior, ends up being converted because it's a question whether they're Jewish or not, and it's a girl that's born, she grows up and 20 years later wants to marry a Kohen. Is she allowed to marry a Kohen, or is she not allowed to marry a Kohen? Because a Kohen is not allowed to marry a convert, but her conversion was not a primary conversion, it was only a conversion out of doubt. So those are the questions that are not yet being asked, but will be asked. And just briefly, our final case, surgery for non-medical indication. A Wisconsin family faced this dilemma recently. Twin teenage sons suffer from autism, and one of them, Cave, began yelling and screaming at the top of his lungs up to 1,000 times a day. It's not clear why he is yelling, and he seems to do it in different environments. So the doctor suggested that he get a vocal cord operation to poke a hole in his vocal cords to decrease the intensity of his yelling and the decibel level of his yelling significantly. So the question is, the performance of an operation on this child, which is not a medical indication per se. The child is medically healthy. They're not performing a procedure that the child needs. The child does not need this surgery medically. And in addition, in terms of consent, clearly the child is not capable of giving consent. Is it permitted to perform this kind of operation or not? To give you an idea of the extremes that people go, this is quite an extreme case of treatment in combination surgeries in the care of the developmentally disabled. This is the case of Ashley, who was dates just a few years back. who was very severely disabled, needed to be carried all the time, wasn't able to walk. Her family actually gave her hormonal treatment over a number of years to maintain her stature as a short stature, because it would be easier to carry her around and easier to move her. And I mean, you sympathize with the family. This is obviously their concern is for the love of their child. This is not an abuse issue. It has to show them quite the contrary. They also removed her uterus because of two concerns, the fear of her getting possibly pregnant, and also that she wouldn't have to undergo the pain of menstruation and the inconvenience of menstruation. And they also removed both breasts, not for medical reasons, but because they needed to use a strap to carry her. They would be more comfortable for her if they did that procedure. So these are extreme cases of doing procedures which are not technically medically necessary for the child, but here's the key: they are to the benefit of the child. And before I conclude with that, just for this study, so for example, the Ramoshes et al. Has asked the following questions about the developmentally disabled child, about whether it's permitted to do things which aren't necessarily halakhically problematic. So, for example, to put them in an institution where they might be eating non-kosher food. There's a fear of a child getting pregnant. You could want to perform the hysterectomy because of that fear. Here again, you're doing things for the child which aren't necessarily technically for the medical benefit of the child. But ultimately, the answer was in the affirmative because of the following reasons. Because even though it's not in a very restricted sense medically beneficial for the child, it is clearly to the child's benefit to have their caretakers be able to care for them in a certain way, and ultimately they will be the beneficiaries of better life and better care through these types of interventions. So I think that would similarly apply to this vocal cord surgery place. Admittedly, it is not a medical benefit, but if this is going to impede the ability for his parents to treat him, for all caretakers to care for him, if his perpetual scream is going to impede his relationship with his twin brother, which it did, then this surgery, which is of relatively limited risk, relatively safe procedure, and it did not impact his ability to communicate or get his needs met, because he was still able to phonate, he was still able to verbalize, just simply not at that higher level, and because it facilitates family's care and relationship with the brother. So normally it could be potential for a kavalah, for wounding him unnecessarily, but I think since it's ultimately to his benefit, it would be something which would likely be halakhically permitted. Thank you very much.
For our last speaker, I'd like to call Rabbi Steinberg, and we have three more cases to discuss.
What is Shabbos today?
142 is
The cases, as I'm sure you saw them, I'll go over them briefly. Each of them deserves really a whole lecture, probably a whole session. But I'll try to give just the main points and the way I see them, whatever comes out of it. So the first case that I was asked to discuss was an issue of a child, 10 years old, with leukemia that refuses to get chemotherapy. Her parents refuse to give her chemotherapy, and they instead want to treat her naturally, believing that natural treatment will be better, both prognostically and obviously less side effects, and both the child itself, herself, and the parents insist to go this route. So the question is, what do we do halakhically in such a case? I think we should look at it from several major points. One is, how is this child defined halakhically as far as her potential of life is concerned. In other words, is it Chaye Olam or Chaye Shor? That makes a major difference from a halachic point of view. Again, without going into all the sources distinguishing it and what it means, I'll just mention very briefly that if someone has Chaye Shor, which means that Chaye Shor doesn't mean 1 hour, it means a temporal life that is limited, and the limitation, I'll say a word later, but assuming we know what the limitation is, in a Chaye Shor situation, according to almost all poskim, except for very few who disagree, a person has the autonomous right to forego life prolonging treatments because of suffering, because of severe side effects, even though it will cause an earlier death if the patient would have taken the full treatment. Whereas in Chaye Olam, there is no such option. Autonomy is limited. The value of life is greater than the value of autonomy in Jewish law, and a patient doesn't have this option. Whether he should be coerced or not, we heard a little bit, we heard earlier about it. I'll just touch on it very briefly. So the question is Chaye Olam versus Chaye Shor. Now, Chaye Shor is discussed in the Talmud, discussed in Shulchan Aruch, discussed in Rambam, but nowhere do we find a definition. What is Chaye Shor? We know it's not living forever, but no one is living forever. When we say, as opposed to Chaye Shor, Chaye Olam, doesn't mean that anyone lives forever. Olam doesn't mean forever. Means more than Chaye Shor. So what is the cutoff point? So most poskim hold that the cutoff point is 12 months, equating Chaye Shor to Treifa, and Treifa, according to the Gemara, is 12 months. So the assumption is that the definition, the practical definition of Chaye Shor, is like Treifa, and that would be 12 months. So if a person has a life expectancy of less than 12 months, he is allowed to forego treatments that prolong life that are pertaining to the disease. He's not allowed to forego food and fluid or some basic treatments or treatments that he gets anyway for a chronic disease prior to becoming a Chaye Shor, but treatments that are pertaining to the situation that caused him to be Chaye Shor, he is allowed to forego. Whereas if it's Chaye Olam, we heard from Rabbi Glad, the Moruch Tzia, that we can even enforce life-saving treatments on someone that the treatment will prolong his life beyond 12 months, if that would be the definition. And even if he refuses, we don't respect his refuse and we treat him against his wish. So, a leukemic patient today, in most instances, or in many instances, is not a Chaye Shor. There are treatments that can really cure the disease, or at least cause long remissions, and a patient who is receiving appropriate chemotherapy for leukemia can live longer than 12 months, and therefore, even an adult leukemic patient cannot refuse such a treatment, certainly not replace it with a treatment that is not a treatment, that is not proven to be a treatment. Now here, not only is a leukemic patient not allowed to take such a decision, but the one who takes the decision is a minor, and certainly a minor doesn't have the capability to make life and death decision that would be acceptable. And I think even in secular legal circumstances, a G witness that is an adult and refuses blood transfusion in this country would be respected, but a minor that the parents don't want to give a blood transfusion for legitimate reasons from their point of view will be forced to get the treatment in order to save his life, and therefore That is very similar to halachic ruling that a minor cannot make such decisions. By the way, the definition of a minor is different. The secular and the legal circumstance usually is 18 years. In halachic parameters, it would be 12 years for a female, but in this case, it happened to be 10 years, so obviously halacha and the secular law would coincide. So it seems to me that we should overrule this decision of both the parents and the child. Now, as far what they say actually is not that they don't want to treat the child. They don't say they want the child to die. They say that they have an alternative treatment that is better. Should we accept this position and say both we as a society and physicians want to prolong the life of the child, the child himself, herself and her parents want to prolong the life, the question is what type of treatment should we use, and they prefer a different type of treatment. So here we have already in Chazal a ruling that I think applies today even stronger. In the days of Chazal, obviously, there was no chemotherapy and no radiotherapy and no such types of treatments. But whatever treatment there was then assumed to be beneficial had to be proven to be beneficial. And that is called a kameya munche, shel munche. In other words, it had to have two parameters, that the type of treatment, that the kameya, should have proven itself at least three times to be beneficial to this particular disease, and it should be done by someone who has used it already three times and proved to be beneficial. So it's sort of double-sorted effect, that it has to be proven as beneficial according to the standards that are available in the particular period of time. So in the Talmudic time, they assume that three times by the same person, three times by the same kameya, is a proven treatment, and therefore you can use it, and you can even desecrate Shabbos for it. Nowadays, the way to prove a treatment is different, but it's the same concept. So if experimentally a proven treatment is known and one wants to substitute it with a treatment that is not proven, that is not permissible because, again, life takes precedence over these autonomous decisions that go on. By the way, Israel has a unique law on this matter, which I don't think in the United States or Canada would have been accepted. Israel recognizes autonomy, as I said several times. We are the 51st state of the United States, and if here it's acceptable, obviously Israel accepts it. But still, the value of life has some place in Israel greater than in the United States. It took us a long discussion and a long fight a few years ago to implement it, to show that we are still a little bit different than other countries, and the value of life is of importance, and therefore there is a paragraph in the Israeli law that says that if a treatment is life-saving, beneficial, and certainly better than non-treatment, and the patient refuses the treatment, an ethics committee has the power to enforce the treatment of the patient, provided three conditions are fulfilled. One is that the patient was explained, we explained the patient why he should take this treatment and why it's better for him to do so. Secondly, that the benefit much overrides the detrimental aspects of the non-treatment, and thirdly, that the ethics committee has reason to believe that post factum, the patient will consent to the treatment that he is getting now against his wish. So some say, well, you want now ethics committee members that are prophets, because you have to now assume that when it will happen, it will be acceptable by the patient. But it is not so. And if you really take autonomy seriously and you want to understand the patient, there are cases where you can predict it. We had such a case at Charlotte Sedek. There was once a woman with cancer of the colon who refused treatment to the cancer, and she was terminal, and we accepted her request, and we didn't treat directly her cancer. But she came in with an obstruction of the bowel because of the cancer, and she suffered terribly with vomiting, pain, and it was terrible. So the physicians asked her to agree to have a limited procedure just to open the obstruction, not to treat the cancer, but have the rest of her life in a much easier way. And she refused. And we couldn't understand why she refuses. It didn't make sense to us because she suffered terribly and it was a limited procedure and it was according to her wishes not to treat the major illness and not to prolong her life from the basic problem. And therefore we decided to enforce the treatment. And the treatment was done and the bowel obstruction was opened, and when she woke up, she felt much better, and after a day, she bought us flowers. And she thanked us enormously. So I asked her, what was before and what is now? So she said that she is a Holocaust survivor, and she is afraid of people putting her to sleep because she underwent all kinds of torture in the camps in Germany, and to her it's all the same what people are doing, and therefore she refused. She didn't tell us because she thought that we would think that she is crazy, but that was her feeling. But now that we didn't do what she expected would be done because of her Holocaust experience, she certainly is thankful because now she feels good and so on. So in other words, if you see a patient that refuses something which is reasonable and they are suffering terribly and yet don't want it, you have good reason to believe that it is done out of something which doesn't make sense, and hopefully when it will be done successfully, they indeed will be thankful and therefore will accept it. So that is from the legal point of view. From a halachic point of view, it was done whether she would consent later or not, because this was going to kill her right away, and we were there in order to save her life. So, bottom line, if, and again, I don't know the details and the stages and then what has been done so far, but assuming that it's a typical leukemic patient that did not finish yet the available treatment, she is not considered at the moment as chayisha. Even if she is an adult, she has no right to refuse. She can't substitute it with something which is unproven, and certainly as a minor, she cannot accept. Now, her parents are her surrogates, and her parents say, we don't want the treatment. Should we listen to the parents? Once again, the parents have responsibility over their children, but not absolutely. And if we as society feel that the parents are taking a wrong decision for their child, we should intervene. And we have several such cases at Charlotte Sedek where parents decided not to give certain treatments to their children. We went to the courts and we got a ruling that overrides the parents' position, and we saved the lives of the children, certainly overriding the parents' wishes, which is not an autonomy in the regular sense of the word. So that is case number one in a nutshell. Case number two has to do with harvesting dead girl's eggs. Coming from Israel, the story of a 17-year-old person who died in a car accident, and her parents wanted to harvest her eggs in order to use them subsequently to have grandchildren from the dead daughter that died in the car accident. Similarly, there are discussions in this vain on taking sperm after death from a male who dies, and the parents want a grandchild from this son, and we can harvest the sperm and use it subsequently. Are we allowed to do it? As far as sperm post after death, I discussed this matter with Rav Nechemia Goldberg, and there are some other rabbis who already discussed this issue. To the best of my knowledge, it wasn't yet discussed concerning harvesting eggs. It may be similar, but it may be not similar. So let me start with sperm. There is a question whether harvesting sperm, or that would be the same or even stronger with eggs, is a form of desecrating the dead, is a form of deriving benefit from the dead, and is a form of avoiding the burial of this part of the dead person. So are we allowed the chatchila to take sperm from a dead person? I'm not talking about a situation where a person has already sperm in a bank, let's say prior to chemotherapy, we take sperm in order that if he survives and he becomes infertile, we can use his sperm. That is a separate issue. We are talking about someone that didn't have sperm prepared, he died, and we can take the sperm within 24 hours or so after death and keep the sperm and implant it to a woman and have a child for this particular person. So there is a debate whether this is permissible chatchila to do. My personal opinion is that it is permissible, and again I won't go into the whole debate, the halachic debate, why it's not desecrating the dead and deriving benefit and not burial. I think it is. I have written extensively about it. It's beyond the question now, but assuming that it's permissible to do it and we obtain sperm, should we do it for the sake of having a child to this dead person because someone wants a child from him? Obviously, he doesn't want it. So Zalman Nechemia has an interesting distinction. He says if the dead male is married, then we are allowed to do it with his widow. In other words, take his sperm and impregnate his wife, his widow, and have a mutual child, because the assumption is that if someone marries, he wants a child. So it's as if he said, by all means, I want a child. And therefore, it's like his wish to have a child, and if we have the opportunity to do it with his wife, then that would be permissible. But if it is an unmarried person, and the one who wants the child are her parents, his parents, and they want a grandchild from a woman that he didn't know at all, it would be a foreign woman who is willing to have, to carry the pregnancy and have a child for this particular dead son, that, according to him, would not be permissible. The exact halachic distinction is not very clear. I think it's more a halachic policy rather than a pure halachic decision, but that was his position. In other words, he felt that from Yibum we learn that a person wants a child, by all means. So what's the whole concept of Yibum? If someone dies childless, his wife has to marry his brother in order to have a child in his memory. So the Torah felt that someone who is married wants a child. But someone who is not yet married, we don't know if at all he wants a child, and certainly he couldn't imagine that he'll have a child from a woman that he didn't know it, wasn't married to. So then it's so far from the concept of Yibum that we don't have any source to say that that would be permissible. However, obtaining eggs is even more complicated in a sense. So it has the same questions, whether it's nivola med, whether it's deriving benefit, whether it's not bearing this fault. And even if we would assume that it would be permissible only if this woman had a husband, and the husband wants a child, the difference is that here we need a surrogate mother. If a male dies, his widow can have the child as if they were together. But if a female dies and the husband wants a child, he can't become pregnant with the egg of his, at least at the moment. Things may change, but at the moment, he can't become pregnant, so he needs a surrogate mother. Would that be too far a step, like a parent who wants a grandchild, or is it still within the parameter that this couple wants a child, and therefore it would be even permissible then? As I said, I did not yet discuss it with any of the poskim, and I didn't see anyone relating to it, so I'm not sure that is the right answer. And finally, the third case here has to do with wrongful birth. There are two cases here. One is a child born with no arms and one leg, and one is a child born with Down syndrome, and the parents filed a lawsuit for medical negligence, and the claim in these cases is, if the physician would have done the right testings during pregnancy and discovered this disease, the parents would have elected to abort the child. And since the physicians either didn't do the test or did it and misinterpreted it and didn't inform the parents that the fetus has this particular ailment and the child was born, it's a life of suffering, it's a wrongful life, and therefore the parents will get compensation, or the child will get compensation for being born in this situation. So that is really not unusual. I mean, these two cases are only some examples. I know that here there were quite a few lawsuits. In Israel, it's an epidemic. In Israel, there are lawyers who go to Arab villages where they intermarry. There are a lot of damaged children. They come to the parents and say, we will file a lawsuit against the physicians for you, because they get 30-40% out of such a lawsuit, and it's millions of shekelim, and it's really an epidemic. And the courts went along with it for a long time in Israel, to the degree that even if discovering this particular rare disease would have taken to do testings which are not even available in Israel, which would mean that the physician would have needed to tell the mother, if you want to be sure that you don't have this and this disease, go to England or to the United States, they have a special test for it, do it there on your account, will cost you as much as it will cost, and you'll know if you want this child or not. The physician failed to inform it, the child was born, the court said negligence, and you have to pay money, which really went far overboard for any reasonable medical practice. And philosophically or legally, the one that claims the damage was, up to recently in Israel at least, the child himself. The child, through his parents, is filing a lawsuit against wrongful life. He should not have been born to begin with, and because he was born, he is claiming. Why was it done in this fashion? Why don't the parents come and say, you didn't tell us, you were negligent towards us, and we are filing a lawsuit? Because if the parents are the ones that filed the lawsuit, they can claim a small amount of money for having trouble raising such a child, or for having expenses to raise the child, or for violating their autonomy, that would be a relatively small amount of money. The child himself has an enormous amount of suffering, and therefore the amounts of money are much greater. And also, if the parents claim, then there is the law that it's only for a limited time that they can claim. The statute of limitation applies to them. So let's say, I think it's 7 years or so that they can claim. If the child himself is the claim, he can claim any time, because as long as he's alive, he can claim. So that amounted to enormous sums of money that compensation was awarded. I personally, although I was opposed to the concept, at least from the child's point of view, because to say that someone has wrongful life, that is conceptually very bothersome to me, but I was part of the system from my pediatric neurology aspect, so that if parents came to me and said, we need an expert witness to say what the damage is and how much the damage is and could it be detected early or not, the truth is that there is damage. I couldn't say no, but I tried to show that the damage is relative. So I'll tell you one story. A visionist couple, very Hasidic from people, had a child with meningomyelitis, with an open back, with the spinal cord out, with paralysis of the legs, with incontinence, with hydrocephalus, a child that is really suffering, and that's a fact, we can't avoid it. And they filed this lawsuit, and obviously in the lawsuit, it's built in that if it would have been discovered during pregnancy, they would have aborted the child. And because it wasn't discovered, they couldn't abort, and now they're claiming. So I asked the mother, are you serious? If you would have known that the child has meningomyelitis, is there one poison in the Chassidish community that would allow abortion? So she said, I wouldn't ask, I would do it on my own. I guess for money, you say a lot of things. And when I testified in court, I said that indeed, the damage is X, Y, Z, and so on, and it could have been detected easily, it wasn't detected. But I think that there was no damage done to this particular couple, because even if they would have been told, it would be very unlikely that they would have had a child. Like we see many meningomyelitis children born to Hasidic families knowing that it's meningomyelitis, but no poison allows them to abort, so there wasn't really damage to this couple. It went on and on, it's now at the Supreme Court, there's a whole discussion around this. Do we take into account the specifics of this claim, or do we look at the whole picture, and as a whole picture, it doesn't matter if indeed they would have aborted or not, there was negligence, and the child is suffering, and therefore they should pay. Recently, the government established a committee in Israel to look into this issue because, as I said, it's an epidemic. And I was asked to be part of this committee, and what we decided was that there is philosophically no room for wrongful life. Once a person is born, his life is as important as any other life. You have to take care of it, you can't kill it, you can't do any damage to it, it's life, and therefore you can't claim wrongful life. All you can claim is that the parents had a violation of their autonomy by not telling them, and they can claim a certain amount of money, obviously to take care of the child, and somewhat more in order to compensate for the violation of autonomy. And to my surprise, the Israeli Supreme Court accepted this recommendation, and that is now the ruling in Israel. I don't know how it's being dealt with in the United States or Canada, whether there is such a concept of wrongful life, or whether it's just the violation of their autonomy towards parents, but that is the status in Israel. And one more point, and that is the halakhic issue. what is considered negligence. So certainly from a halakhic point of view, the situation that I described earlier, that there is a test somewhere in the world that should have been informed to the parents, and by not telling them that is a violation of their autonomy, that is certainly not a halakhic negligence. Halakhic negligence is discussed primarily by dayanim, not by physicians, but it applies to physicians as well. And there is a distinction between ta'a b'dvar mishnah and ta'a b'shikul hadat. If someone makes a mistake in something which is clearly stated and obvious, that is a mistake that he has to pay for. But if he made a mistake in shikul hadat, in his assumptions, he thought that this is sufficient to do and it's reasonable, and that's the standard of care, he doesn't need to go overboard and to be the most experienced person to say that you could do even more than the standard care. That is not called a negligence, and halakhically, he is exempt from pay. In other words, that is not a negligent act. So I think that applying it to the medical situation would be the same. If there is a standard of follow-up in pregnancy and the physician neglected to do it, or if there is a test that was done and the results are clear that there is a problem and he didn't see it or didn't understand it, that is negligence. But if the expectation is to do something very outstanding, or whether it was a doubtful result that people can interpret one way or the other, that may be a mistake, but that's not negligence, and therefore this should be another distinguishing point in a legal system, which at the moment is not acceptable by the judges in Israel. We are still in progress and in work to convince them that they should follow the halakhic understanding of what is negligence and what is not. Thank you.
So, I'd like to invite the speakers to the panel here, and we'll open up the floor for questions.
Thank you. Brilliant presentation. Two questions for the man, the dead male whose semen is harvested and impregnates his widow, where he never had children before he died, and she gets pregnant and has a baby, would she still be chalitza? Second question, so I'll ask both, and then you can respond whichever one you want. The situation where they decline to have the chemotherapy, we get that as a child, let's assume it's an adult, and that the side effects are horrific, vomiting, all sorts of pain, but the chemotherapy is efficacious, but it's creating tremendous side effects. Is the individual allowed to decline the chemotherapy, even though it's efficacious, because they don't want to suffer the side effects?
Okay, to the first question, that's an interesting debate between the poskim, how to relate to a child that was born after his father died. Is the father the father? Can a father be father when the child was born after he died? So the distinction is between whether the sperm was already out while he was alive and subsequently he died, and a situation where the sperm was obtained after the person died. If the sperm was obtained prior to the death of the person, according to Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, the male is the father for all purposes except for Yibum B'chalitza. And his concept was that the fact that there was sperm in the world when he died does not mean that the person has halakhically a child. Why? Because he is missing an act. You have to implant the sperm in order for a child to be born. That's called halakhically mechusar maise. And if something is mechusar maise, it's not a maise. So therefore, at the moment that he died, the woman needed Yibum B'Chalitza. Why? Because at this particular moment, there was no child. There was a potential child, but there was no child. If the woman was impregnated and the person died after an hour after impregnation, then if a child is born, she is potter from Yibum B'Chalitza because there is no Mechusar Maaseh. That is already sort of an automatic pilot once the woman becomes pregnant. According to Arab Israeli, a person who dies is not a father for any purpose. Because he said, I don't know any situation where a person can be a father when he's not in the world at all, at the time when fatherhood is being created. And therefore, according to him, not only Yibum B'Chalitza is the woman Mechuyav, but the child will not inherit this male, and won't say Kaddish on him, and so on, because it's not his father. If the whole process was done after the person died, even according to Shlomo Loyerbach, he is no father at all. Because at the time that he died, there was no relationship, even potentially, to the child that was born subsequently from a sperm that was taken out after the person died. But Yibum B'Chalitza, in both instances, the woman will be mechuyav according to both shittas.
And which child will be mechuyav?
Well, same thing. If he's a father and if he's a kohen, the child is a kohen. If not, not.
But genetically, you're going to say no, he's not. But genetically, maybe.
Right. But we know that genetics is not an all or none phenomenon in halacha. It is important. But, for instance, we know genetically that a child born to a father who is a Kohen and a mother that is not a Kohen is only half a Kohen, genetically. But halachically, it's a full Kohen. So, we don't take genetics so seriously. There are halachic rulings, and the halachic rulings sometimes overrule the genetic system. As far as your second question, the general rule is that if there is a chance, the Chaye Olam, to cure or to prolong life beyond 12 months, one has no right to refuse such a treatment, even if it entails suffering. Now, that is a general rule. If suffering is so unbearable that no one can withstand it, then maybe individually it can be discussed. But as a general rule, that is not sufficient to say that we'll forego treatment. Moreover, nowadays, with palliative care, there are ways to ameliorate such suffering to a degree that in most instances, at least, it's bearable, and the chances to survive and to live take precedence over this type of suffering.
As a follow-up on that, Rabbi Steinberg, halakhically, they get the minor. The minor, you know, obviously the court's going to see that perhaps forced therapy. But in an adult, are you obligated to force the person to get therapy? Tie them down, do whatever you need to do? Or is it just an obligation for the person to say that I should have therapy, and if I refuse, then halachically you've sinned?
Well, purely halachically speaking, it seems from most poskim that you even have to tie up someone in order to save his life. Because, as we say, life, the body doesn't belong to us, the body belongs to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says you have to live. So the fact that you refuse is really irrelevant. Practically speaking, it's not always possible. You can't call in police and fight with this person. So on a practical level, sometimes we give up. It happens. But we should try to convince as much as possible. And again, purely halachically, it should be done that way. I say purely halachically because there are qualifications to it. I already mentioned earlier, the question is, who should enforce? That's not a simple halachic shayla. Is it the best thing that you need to do it? Is it an individual? There's a big machloikus on any mitzvah. Who can enforce someone to fulfill the mitzvah? And also, in medicine, things are not black and white. So you can assume that this treatment really will cause the person to survive beyond 12 months, but maybe the patient can find opinions that will say that it's questionable, and maybe there are other options, so that to enforce really in practical terms, it might be more difficult unless it's a clear-cut case, like the Mo'tzia, for instance, that talks about, I assume, a gangrenous leg of a diabetic person, and you know that if you amputate the foot, the person will survive, and if you leave it that way, he will die. So it's clear-cut one way or the other. But if it's more complicated, and you talk about statistics, the person can say, I feel myself belonging to the other statistics, and therefore it's doubtful if you can force it. So these are individual cases. I'm talking about the principle is here.
What is the percentage in halacha that you use to say that it's chaya halacha? In other words, let's say we say it's a 20% chance to live for much more than 12 months, or a 30% chance. What percentage does halacha look at?
So there are two aspects to looking into these percentages. One is whether I'm at all allowed to take the chance for a certain percentage to survive, whereas on the other hand, the treatment may kill me earlier. So that is one aspect. For instance, you know that chemotherapy can prolong life by 10%, but it can hasten death by 20%. So where are the cutoff points? Vlad mentioned earlier that it's a 50%. That is the opinion of most, but not all. Rabbi Yashiv was of the opinion that it's 30%. Beyond 30%, you're not allowed to take the risk. And according to Rav Moshe, probably even 90% mortality. If you have 10% chance to survive, but it's 100% that you'll die, you're allowed to take the chance. Whether you are enforced to take it, that has to be closer to 100% success and 0% mortality from the treatment, as close as possible to that, in order to enforce the treatment.
Dr. Esther.
Another excellent presentation
this evening.
This is Rabbi Yehuda Levy, and we're regarding this, you know, this voluntary, you have to treat. What happens with Jane Whitney?
Well, if a J witness would have been a Jew, otherwise we can't enforce of non-Jews their... No, from a Jewish point of view, if someone, let's take a sort of quote-unquote an equivalent. Let's say someone says, because of my Jewish understanding, I want to fast on Yom Kippur knowing that it will kill me. The halacha is that we force him to eat. Nothing takes precedence over life, except for the three cardinal sins. So, not eating blood, namely, according to their interpretation, not even transfusion blood, is, in our terminology, a lot, right? Let's say that they are right with their interpretation, and it's a lot. A lot, you should override for the sake of life, halachically. So you would enforce it. If someone says that Shabbos today, I don't want to desecrate Shabbos, and he'll die because of it, you force him to desecrate Shabbos. So it would be the same if there would have been such a halachic law that you're not allowed to get the blood transfusion regularly. If it would mean that you die, we would enforce it. Adult or young, doesn't matter. No, the J witness, in Israel, by the way, I think there was one precedent that they really enforced it. I don't know why. I don't remember the legal basis for it. But I'm not sure. I didn't think about it. Whether we as Jews have to enforce a non-Jew to follow our way of understanding the difference between a love and lust? I don't know. I don't know if there's such a thing. I assume yes, but okay.
I had this at my hospital this year. I'll hold raise a question where we were asked to go to court and obtain a legal guardianship on a neonatal ICU patient who was a witness, and the parents refused to allow a transfusion. So we went and did it. I don't know if we were mechuyev to or not. I could not get a clear-cut answer from Rabbanim who I asked in terms of whether we had an obligation to do so. We decided to do so.
Yeah, so again, just to stress, if it would be within Jewish life, then the answer is clear. If it is from a Jewish perspective towards a non-Jew, I don't know what the answer is. By Israeli law, yes. The Israeli law doesn't distinguish. Right. So I'm saying that the legal courts in Israel enforced it. I just don't know why and what, but there was a fact.
The United States government, in the this Canadian citizenship case that Robert Black talked about, with respect to the genetic material not being native Canadian. Many years ago, the United States government had a claim by the child of a U.S. soldier who was on duty at the Los Alamos nuclear tests, and the child was born with deformities as a result of the irradiation of the genetic material of the father, who was on active duty in the United States Army. And the defense of the Justice Department of that case was that the father, the resulting child that made the claim, had the claim only because of the damage to the father's genetic material while he was active duty as a soldier, for which the United States had no liability other than giving him Veterans Administration benefits, which the child could avail himself of. And that's the position the government took, which is consistent with what the Canadian government did many years later, which is that the genetic material would govern. And my recollection is the government won that case.
By the way, just in Israel, the law is that there's no possibility to do surrogacy unless at least one part is genetically related to the future child. So this case would not have been allowed in Israel, the Chathila, to do a surrogacy in this fashion, because neither the sperm nor the egg came from the couple that became pregnant and wants the child.
We had a case over here, I don't know the results. It was a 12-year-old boy who had cancer and was going to be treated with chemotherapy. The parents wanted the child to be put to sleep, have an electronic stimulation to produce sperm that they could keep for later, for when the boy gets married many years later and wants to have children. I wonder if you could comment on this.
Yeah, we also had several such cases. I know that the ruling was not to allow it. It's very painful. It's very uncomfortable. It was a Haredi family that was offered to do it. The child was 15 or 16 years old, who was never educated about sex, about sperm, about anything. He was really totally ignorant of the whole procreation aspects, and the feeling was that it was not right to do it. I don't know if it was a halakhic decision, but that is how the parents requested.
Fertility preservation has also undergone some major advances in the last couple of years. So, until recently, it was impossible to preserve fertility in a pre-adolescent child. So if a child who already has mature sperm, there was a possibility either through electrical stimulation or testicular aspiration, at least to obtain sperm. But now it's possible that there's a relatively new procedure called spermatogonial stem cell extraction, which is potentially promising and very exciting in the field of fertility preservation in oncology, which hasn't yet been addressed by the postscheme. But in essence, what it involves is doing a testicular aspiration from a child at any age, a boy, you're talking male in this particular case, harvesting the spermatogonial stem cells, which could be cultured and developed later on into sperm, should that, it's a shame if that child recovers, and it could either be re-implanted back into that individual or even potentially cultured in the laboratory and then used for in vitro fertilization to preserve fertility. So, and on the female side, there's a lot of advances in fertility preservation also. Egg harvesting, it used to be you could only preserve fertilized eggs, now you can harvest eggs, as was evidenced by the case that Dr. Steinberg talked about posthumous harvest of eggs. But these are really frontier questions that postmen haven't yet addressed. And the halakhic issue, by the way, is an issur of sirus. You're not allowed to do any anatomical dissection of the genital organs, which includes the testicles, it includes the vas deferens, it includes the shaft. There are very specific halachas whether that renders somebody a sirus. Sirus would not be able to marry into the people of Israel, technically. But of course, this is not done for destructive purposes, this is done for reproductive purposes. And Rav Moshe Potkin, for the sake of harvesting sperm for fertility, standard fertility treatment, to do a testicular biopsy would be halachically permissible. Perhaps my assumption may not necessarily be true that would be applied to these cases of testicular aspiration in the pre-adolescent male child also for the preservation of fertility.
I would just add to that, I've spoken with a number of oncologists and ovarian oncologists here. I was under the impression that it is almost standard part of the procedure that they will offer this to a post-adolescent young man in terms of when they're giving them various therapies that would render them permanently sterile, that option of preserving their sperm before they undergo the radiation, before they undergo whatever procedure it is that would make them sterile, that those techniques were both halakhically and medically sanctioned and recommended. So I don't know if there are any oncologists here who have a different opinion. The other thing that I just would in on to what Rabbi Rachman just said, which is, I think, a great subject for next year, and that is the young woman who is hitting the age of 30, 32, and is not yet married, and there is great medical evidence to suggest that harvesting her unfertilized eggs at that point in time and preserving them for what, you know, Hashem, will be a marriage when she's 32, 34, 38, in vitro fertilization on eggs below roughly the age of 30, 32 is highly, highly much more successful than doing the same exact technique on a egg of a woman who's 36, 38. And the question, therefore, comes up, should we almost be offering all young women at the age of 30, 32, whatever is best scientific evidence, I don't think is known yet, let's say at the age of 32, if a woman is not yet married and is interested, obviously, in eventually having children in a halachically acceptable manner, that she should be undergoing standard routine egg harvesting for future use in Yitzhak Shem and Hera, that she should get married. But every year that goes by decreases the likelihood that both routine, normal relations, as well as assisted reproductive technologies will be successful. And that's a very, very, very interesting technology.
If I could just comment that in pediatric oncology, what we do is we do offer this, but we also have the ability to offer preservation of eggs to children who are not yet pubescent, even into infancy, we're looking at now. And we take this very seriously because we believe we can preserve fertility in a great number of our kids. So yes, we do. We are required actually to offer sperm collection to everybody who is post-pubescent.
Just a brief comment on the things. Harvesting egg or even taking a wedge of the ovary and preserving that from a very young child has no halachic problem with it. There's no halachic issue in it. So I think it should be offered to young children, young female children, in order to have the preservation of their fertility. And what Dr. Reichman mentioned about taking testicular biopsy, that is exactly what I talked last night about sort of mishtanu atzoi, because according to Chazal, perforating the testicle renders the person possible the call. So Moshe said that now we see not only that it doesn't cause infertility, it's a way to preserve fertility, and therefore nishtanu atvoim, and we're allowed to do it, which is a major, major chiddush, but seems to be right. I mean, that is how it works out.
I'd like to thank the panel and the audience for a question. We're going to go to daven mincha in the shul immediately, so the men can immediately get in. I'm sorry, men and women. Mincha will be at 1:42 in the shul, and then that will be followed by lunch. And have a wonderful day.